All right, welcome back, everybody, to the Quill and Query podcast. As always, my name is Brandon Hall, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host today, Ash. Ash, how are you doing today?
Yep. Anyway, today has been quite a day. This week has been 70 years long, and somehow still recovering from the Richmond water crisis. Just kind of a long...
That's right. You guys had
recovery
that.
Recovery period. Yeah, crazy stuff. But, well, you know, could be worse.
Yeah, I'm glad that sounds like it's not still ongoing, so I guess that's good.
Yeah, but piles of laundry and dishes and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, yeah. How are you?
I have also had a very chaotic Tuesday and just start to the year in general, really, if I'm being honest. It seems like I'm getting paid back for all the vacation that I took at the end of the year for some reason. But
I know. Feels like punishment.
We'll get through it. But yeah, this for everyone joining us today, I'm sure you're well aware this might very well be our last TikTok live episode that you get to see. So if you are choosing to spend today with us, thank you so much. We have some fun hot topics to go over today. I figured why not go out with a bang with some of them. But some of the ones I'm going to talk about today are pity marketing, story length, book pricing, and more. And then I think I have a few other wildcard topics if we have time for them, but we'll see how it goes. But before we get into all that, Ash, we like to do our reading update. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't have much to share here. But do you have anything that you're starting the year off reading, or are you still kind of just taking a break from all that right now?
No, so I have started to read again. It feels crazy to say that. I'm reading We by Yevgeny Zamyatin. It's like an old book from 1924, kind of inspired some like early, like I think 1984 it inspired. Anyway, it was for book club. So I've started on that. And I got a Kindle today, my first ever e-reader. So I'm loading it up with the advanced reader copies I've been sent, which I've had a couple. So I'm excited about that.
Very cool. I have actually never owned like a Kindle or an e-reader, surprisingly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have my iPad, which I really like for like watching stuff and having as a companion to my laptop. I used to write on it nonstop before I got this laptop last year. But it's too big. It's like really heavy and kind of cumbersome to read. And I love physical books. I'm going through my TBR. That's one of my reading goals this year, is to finish all of my TBR. But I was like, I don't know. Like, I feel all the advanced copies I get for advanced reading are all digital. And I don't want to read on my iPad. So I was like, you know what? If I'm going to keep doing this thing, I'm going to splurge and buy Kindle. So I did. And it came in the mail today. And I'm very excited. I've already like organized everything, which is giving me a little fun bump of excitement to read. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I really struggle with reading digitally on like my phone or my tablet, just because there's so many other distractions on there. So, I really should invest in an e-reader at some point. I think that's part of the reason I prefer physical too, is just because it's far harder to get distracted. You can't just switch apps. I mean, I could still pull out my phone, but it's different.
No, I totally feel the same way. That's partially the reason why I also got it, because all the apps on my iPad, all the apps on my phone, I am such an annoying millennial. I'm like addicted. I really am. So... for ease of read, non-distracted, non-glare, being able to like read in bed and like lay on my side and not have to like prop up a book. All of these are very silly reasons, but I think it'll be, and if in a couple months I realize I haven't really touched it, I'll just sell it.
Yeah.
So, not a big deal, but I'm excited. It should be good.
Yeah. Well, definitely let us know how it like affects your reading habits.
I will.
All right, well, moving into some podcast updates, we don't really have a whole lot. Like I said, this might be our last TikTok episode. So if you want to know where to find us after that, we have the link tree available in all our bios. So even when TikTok goes away, you can find it in the Instagram bio. You can listen to us wherever you like to listen to podcasts. As far as the live stream goes, probably switch that over to YouTube starting and see how that goes. But there's a lot of different platforms we can move to. So The only one we're really losing is TikTok. So you'll be able to continue to listen to us everywhere else. And aside from, we have the guest form live in the link tree as well. I've been saying that every episode, but if you want to be a guest on Quill and Query, all you have to do is fill out that guest form and we'll get back to you with some times and more details. And then not really podcast related update, but if you've been watching the show for a while, you've heard Ash and I talk about the Blades for Hire anthology and the ARC signup form for those who are interested in reading that and sharing an ARC review. That is now live as well in, I believe, both mine and Ash's bios. So if you want to get an early look at that, all you have to do is fill out the form. I know I'm giving you a lot of forms to fill out today. they're pretty straightforward, though. All you have to do is answer a few questions. They're not overly complicated or anything.
Yeah. Sorry, pause. I think we just had like a little mini earthquake.
Oh, no. Are you good?
Yeah. Let me just double check. I don't know. I felt like a weird thing earlier.
Yeah. It's all good. Take a minute if you need.
Anyway, no. We're good. Yeah. I just got the notification. Friends were like, did you hear that? Did you feel that? I was like, first of all, I'm recording live. And second of all, kind of maybe. Anyway, not a big deal. We're safe, hopefully.
Okay.
I need everything to just calm down.
It's okay. It just adds to the daily chaos today.
Yep. Anyway, I second Brandon's. Please sign up for advanced copies. Check out our link tree. All of the above.
All right. Well, we have a few indie releases to spotlight. Since this is going to be our last TikTok episode, at least as far as I know, I'm going to give you guys the Blades for Hire release date here as well. But first up, we have The Martyr's Shadow by ID Marie. That's on January 25th. So 11 days from now. If you've been following, that is the third book in her series. So super excited for her and congratulations. And then, of course, we have Blades for Hire coming out February 25th. So if you want to wait till release date, that's when it'll be coming out on Amazon, Kindle, paperback, whatever your preferred format is. Mm-hmm. Also, just real quick, apologies to anyone if I'm a little out of it today because I'm, like I said, it's been a chaotic day and we're just kind of trying to get back into the groove with everything. So
This is the grace period episode where everyone's just gonna listen to us ramble and chat and not judge us.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Ash, did you have anything to add to the updates before we move into our weekly topics?
No, I think you covered it all based off of my very foggy memory. I think we're great.
All right, cool. Well, moving into our weekly topics, I'm going to start off with a relatively easy one, but one that's top of mind because of what we were talking about with Blades for Hire earlier today in the Discord. So that's book pricing. So I don't know about you, but for me, the pricing of a book and its availability and subscriptions kind of play like a subconscious role in whether I'm going to read it or not and when I'm going to get to it. So I was kind of curious if you feel the same way. So what I've seen generally in the author community is that like being enrolled in a program like Kindle Unlimited or having your book priced also too low or too high can lead to readers thinking that it's, you know, of a lower quality or something. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on how do you think that, how do you think about that as a reader? Sorry, like I said,
no, you're
chaotic
good.
Day. But how totally. Do you think about that as a reader, and how does it affect like your purchasing decisions with books?
Yeah, it's kind of complicated. Last year, I didn't really buy any books. I was on like a book buying ban personally, so it's genuinely been kind of a minute. I did the Stuff Your Kindle Day, especially for like the fantasy and the popular genre stuff. I bought a couple for like $3 for my Kindle, well, my new Kindle, but for the Kindle app and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, for digital stuff, I think, I know we talked about it in the Discord, but like anything above like an $8, I'll pay if I love the author. I think that's like the threshold for me.
Yeah.
Physical books, I have to really love the author now. I didn't feel that way years ago when I was just kind of going to Barnes & Noble all the time. But when I did do that, I think if it was above $18, if it started to get into the $20 realm, unless it was like a thick, you know, a thick girl, you know, when it's like, oh, $25, but it's like 700 pages. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. But I don't know. I've just noticed the price of books going up a lot lately for a variety of factors. Some of them valid, some of them I don't think necessarily as valid. But if it's a popular author, you know, I might wait until it goes down on pricing. And again, scattered thoughts here today at the Cool Inquiry podcast. But yeah, I don't know. I think I always am more supportive of indie authors. So I will 100% pay $10 to $15 if it's a new and upcoming author, if I want a physical copy of their book. Kind of same with ebook, because I'm like, I know a good chunk of this is going towards, you know, hosting and all that kind of stuff, and yeah, you just want to support. So way more willing to dish out cash for my friends and local indie authors that I follow, but I'm less inclined nowadays to buy like a new book from an author I don't know if it's above like $15, because I'm like, oh, what if I hate this, you know? So, anyway, what do you think?
I'm going to try to make sure my thoughts are as organized as possible so today.
I don't know what's going on. It's the full moon yesterday. We'll blame it on that.
Yeah, totally. No, I'm in a similar boat. Anything above like $10 for an ebook. Again, there I have like exceptions. Like obviously if Winds of Winter came out tomorrow and it was a $15 ebook, I would buy it. Obviously there are authors who can break the rule. Also realistically, I don't think they would. I think $10 is like my threshold for an ebook, and then preferably closer to like the $5 range. Again, depending on things like length and all of that. And then, of course, indie authors, you know, I understand there's a little bit more of a cost for them there. So a little more forgiving with like the pricing. When it comes to paperbacks and hardcovers and anything physical, really, like significantly depends on length. So a Wind in Truth from Brandon Sanderson, like almost 1400 page book. I would be hard pressed to find that for $20, I think. So understandably, I would be willing to pay more of a premium for a book that is that large. Preferably for a paperback, I'm looking at like $15 to $20 depending on length. And then hardcovers honestly can vary quite a bit. It depends on if it's like a special edition, if it's you know, another huge book, and I think the printing cost with hardcovers varies a little more for depending on where they're being printed, so that's also a factor. But those are kind of like the ranges that I look for. And again, I'm a little more Michael cries in 700 pages. I think your book is pretty fairly priced for the size.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, yeah, same.
So like I said, I'm also willing to pay more for a book that's larger because I know the printing cost is higher. But yeah, that's my kind of scatterbrained thoughts. I don't know if you make $2 per copy. Yeah, so I mean, your royalties are basically at, you know, almost as low as they can go unless you don't want to make any money. So
yeah. Which doesn't feel fair. Right. This is a whole new realm for me. I don't really know anything. You guys were chatting today in the Discord and I was like, I should be the last person to give my opinion on this because I know very little about that. But it does seem a little unfair for, you know, a 700 page plus book to only, you know, the authors only get $2 back. But I think for me personally, I forgot who just released it, but like I think Fairy Loot or something like that just released like a special edition collection of Throne of Glass, like in all black Night Court theme. And it's an unfinished series. Right. So I'm like, I would rather spend my $40 to a bunch of different indie publishers than buy like these crazy special editions, with the caveat, I have bought special editions and I've wanted a special edition collection of another book series, but that would only be two technically of books that I am obsessed with, like series that I am obsessed with.
Yeah.
I understand people want to buy the special edition stuff, but one, if it's unfinished, why would I want an unfinished like special edition series? And two, I feel like a lot of the times it's a money grab from like big publishers where you're like, like, what do you mean? I've been doing thrift books because I'm rereading the Throne of Glass series for a different book club. And I have a funny story about that. I can tell it later. But
okay. Yeah, we'll get to it.
Yeah, thrift books has been great. Library, but I want it for a collection, like just to have, because I do enjoy the series. It's like a, you know, middle school, high school, early college love of mine. Anyway, I try and get books really cheap if I can, if I really want it. I'm not about to go out and buy just the newest, latest, and greatest just because some people like that.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan.
So. Yeah. I like my special editions, but only for kind of like you said, the series that are like really special to me. So
yeah, right. Like Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Like that. And even that I've held off buying like the really like super premium editions of that because it is not finished. And I want to make like, if it gets to the point where it's unfinished forever, then I'll buy them. But if they get the other books, I don't want the special editions to like shift design in some way. And then I have a bunch of mismatched books because that's, I'm really picky about like all the covers have to match on the shelf or I don't want them at all. So, but yeah, I hardly own any special editions. I think the only other ones that I have like a complete set of are the Dune ones with like the colored pages. And those were actually relatively cheap as far as special editions go. Cause I think it's just like new cover art and sprayed edges. So, it's not anything crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked how they looked on the shelf. And they were also like the only consistent covers that I could find in store for Dune. So it was another factor. Versions.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and way too many.
Yeah. It was rough, but
yeah.
But yeah. Like we said, we're exploring book pricing with Blades for Hire. So all of my data comes from readers and my own thoughts of like when I'm shopping for a book, because I haven't, like you, I haven't published anything to KDP yet. So it's really just like, I think like a year ago, I did a poll on book pricing and it was pretty much in line with what I just shared in the Discord, the $5 ebook, the $15 paperback. So yeah, a lot of it's coming from readers, but I think that's a good starting point at least.
Yeah, I would say the same. It's like, what's the average, you know, and then go from there, because you want it to be accessible to people. And if most people in the indie publishing space, me also, and you, I'm sure, are just like, oh yeah, like we monitor our budgets, so we don't want to be spending an ungodly amount. And yeah, I think that's why a lot of people keep it either in the Kindle Unlimited universe or pretty inexpensive, especially for e-versions, because they're like, oh yeah, like, you know, here's a bi-yearly bundle where you can get everything for $10, because they just want their work to be out. And I admire that a lot, because for most of us, it's like not really about making money. It's about just getting your work out there. So.
Well, that's actually a perfect segue into the next topic, getting your work out there. So this next topic, I'm going to just call it with like the blanket term pity marketing, just because because that's how I've seen people talk about it.
Sure.
In the conversations I have had with it. So that's my blanket term for it. I'm sorry if that's like mean.
No, that's hilarious.
This really seems like it's obviously, you know, primarily an indie publishing space thing, just because I don't think people who are writing trad published books face the same challenges here. But essentially, pity marketing is, it can be a wide variety of social media behavior from an author. It could be simply sharing low sales or author struggles. And I've seen all the way up to like just begging people to buy your book. Sometimes in like really, I want to say like tactless ways. not always, but I have seen some examples. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So one, I want to know if you've ever seen this happen. Like if you've ever watched an indie author or any author really use the pity marketing tactics that we're talking about. And then how does that kind of affect your perception of that author, and what like short and long-term effects do you think that would have on the author's brand to other readers?
It's a really good question. Hi, Nicole. I was jumping in the lake after work. I love that for you. I hope it's not freezing like it is here. And if so, yeah,
cold plunge.
Badass. Yeah. So I want to preface before anyone comes for me that yes, we are generalizing, and I know not everyone who does this is like this. I don't like pity marketing. I think it is, as you said, very succinctly tactless. It falls to me in the realm of rage bait, which we have seen a lot recently. And if I think it boils down personally that if you are pity marketing your own work, then it reads as a lack of confidence in your own work. I want you to be more, do you like this, this, and this? Then my book is perfect for you. If you liked this series, you'll love my series. I'm passionate about my book for these reasons. I want you to be confident, and that's going to sell me way more than no one's going to see this, but I really hope you buy my book. You know, and I understand people do it for different reasons. Some people do it for the, like, playing the long game, like get enough engagement and then you can work it into your confidence. But yeah, for some reason, I'm just not a fan. It's the same way of like, I'll see ads for TikTok Shop on here of like, there's only two left, everybody, and then we're sold out forever. And it's like, I'm not falling for it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, like feel confident about your product. I sell it, like sell it to me. So that's how I feel about it personally.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty similar. Like especially with art, I think people have the tendency to forget that they're still selling a product. Like if you are an author and you're trying to sell your book, it's still a product that you're trying to sell to a customer, in this case the reader. And ultimately, as harsh as this might sound, nobody owes you their attention or their money. And if you approach your customer base as if they do, to me, I just don't see any long-term success coming from that. I can see maybe short-term gains coming from people who feel bad for you and it works short-term. But to me, it just seems like it would be overall damaging to your author reputation in the long run. Because one, are the people who are buying it out of pity, are they even really going to read it? Or are they just going to end the relationship at they bought your book and they financially supported you? Personally, I would much rather never engage in pity marketing and have people buy my book because it sounds interesting to them, even if that means my sales are lower than if I would engage in pity marketing, just because I don't want you to buy my book because you feel bad for me. And when I think about it, it's like, I know it's slightly different because we're artists and we're creative and we're putting like a piece of ourselves out there. But to me, I think about it as if like a corporation came out with a product and they're like, we're going to shut down if you don't buy our product. I'm like, okay, why does that matter to me though? Like,
yeah, right.
So not to sound harsh, but it's about supply and demand, right? You have to create the demand for your product because you can't sell it on pity alone. That's not going to get you the success that you want, at least in my opinion.
Totally agree.
And I think it, like you said, it comes off as like you're not confident in the book can sell itself or be well written enough to attract readers on its own. So yeah, that's kind of the summary of how I feel on it. Again, not trying to like talk down to anyone who has done this in the past or anything. I personally don't see it as an avenue that I could ever take or one that I think really creates any long-term success. And that's just kind of how I feel about it in general, but And yeah. that applies to really any product for me too. Not just Same. Books, but another industry that this is pretty prevalent in, it seems very different, but this happens a lot, is streaming. So I stream games a lot. I just do it for fun, but there are a lot of streamers who think that the simple act of them streaming demands compensation. So
right.
The problem with that is there are millions of streamers, so not everybody is going to attain the same level of success. You have to sell yourself, because you, in as a streamer, you are the product. So it's as an author, your book is the product. As a streamer, you're the product. You have to be entertaining. You have to make people come to your channel, and you have to make them stay. That's really how any creative endeavor, I feel like, works. You have to give the customer a reason, really, with any product, to purchase it and to keep coming back. And so as hard as it might be to hear, that's one of the most important lessons I got early in my creative career, because even my day job is in like a creative field. So one of the things you find out very quickly is the supply is very high and the demand doesn't necessarily match that supply. So because there's an endless amount of creative people in the world, but everyone's got limited time. They have limited books they can read. They have limited, you know, whatever it is, the limited movies they can watch, things like that. So
yeah.
Sorry that I got on a little bit of a,
no, that was great. Side that tangent was fantastic. There, but I totally agree with you. It feels like a shaky foundation to build something on.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's like a integrity thing. You know, I'm not going to read something or buy something from someone who isn't confident in what they are trying to sell. And I would rather purchase or read something from someone who's like, I don't care about success, I just want you to have this, than someone doing it for the wrong reasons, if that makes sense. Some people just write for the popularity, you know, especially with the discourse recently, smutty books and, you know, whatever. It's like, yeah, some people do hop on the bandwagon and think that, oh, this is popular, so I'm going to do it too. Mm-hmm. And then get mad when everyone else is also doing similar things and their work gets drowned out. And then they're like, oh no, I thought I was going to have insta success. And that's just
not.
You got to work for it. And I'm like,
right.
I don't put a lot of work into my own author page, so I'm not going to be mad if my follower count stays low. You know, it's just, you got to do the work. Unfortunately, it's inevitable. And I'd rather it be like cohesive, confident work than nothing at all. So,
yeah, totally. That kind of perfectly encapsulates this next topic. So, I know we touched
on a roll.
Yeah. We kind of touched on this a little bit, but the next topic is art as a business. So I saw this tweet from 2022 circulating in some online writing communities, mostly on Reddit. But essentially, I got a notification on my phone. Essentially, it's a user struggling with their mindset about writing and authorship as a business. So I'm just going to read it, and then the YouTube video, I'll put it on the screen for anyone who wants to actually see it, but I'll read it for everyone who's either here on TikTok or gonna listen to the audio. Cool. So the tweet says, so let me get this straight. We're supposed to write, read, edit, proofread, and format our books, make ads, maintain social media accounts, run blogs and newsletters, make fancy graphics, read other books, study writing, and still have time to write more books. This kind of captures a mindset that I've seen in the indie author community. So are you good?
Yeah, I'm just like, okay. You have, right? Yes.
Well, yeah, that's I just saw you had a big smile on your face. So
no, like, sorry. Dude, stuff like that really just grinds my gears. I'm like, I know you're going to continue. There's nuance to everything like that. It's the same. It's kind of like the Barbie monologue. Like, women are supposed to be and do all of these things, whatever. Mm-hmm. And in that regard, it's much more entrenched in certain aspects in society. We might not even think about it. With that, you are electing to do that. You're choosing to do it. So, yeah, you do have to be all of those things and do all of those things. Mm-hmm. And maybe your success rate is not what you thought, but guess what? You still did it. And that in of itself is a powerful thing to have accomplished and done, despite the fact that, yes, you do need to do all of those things. You have to. Yeah. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, no, I was just going to ask what your thoughts on this overall like approach to writing and publishing and this mindset is. Because for me, I'm very much in the same camp of when I read this, I was like, yeah, you are supposed to do all those things. With the caveat of there is nuance to that answer, right? So if you want to pursue a full-time author career in self-publishing, you very likely will be doing all of those things. Much like any full-time job, you will be doing many things. As at my day job, I do a lot of things. I don't have a one-note job. So, and sometimes my boss will come to me with something that's maybe a little outside of the scope of what I'm used to, but if I can try it, I'll do it. You know, it's right. So I feel like there's a lot of authors who start their career and are like, well, I just want to write and I want the money to come in. And unfortunately, that's not the reality, right? So talking again about supply and demand, there are millions of people who want to write books and who market themselves as authors. There's only so many readers and so much time for people to read books. So you need, again, not saying like every other author is your competition, but in a way, other books are your competition. And you, because you're competing for mindshare and time spent reading. So as a creative, if you want to be a full-time self-published author, yeah, you have to do all those things, or you have to find a way to outsource some of those things if it's too much. And then if you want to go the trad route, they'll take care of many of those things for you, so you can focus on the writing aspect. But then there's a higher demand of like a higher desire for creatives to go into trad publishing, so the barrier for entry is also going to be much higher because they can't take everybody. So you have to keep those things in mind. Like, there's nuance to it. Like, yeah, you do have to do all those things if you want to create a successful self-publishing career, or you can try to stand out in the crowd and go trad publishing, and just, you're going to have to be more competitive to get in. So it, it's really just, what do you want your career to look like? And what aspects of the work do you want to do? Like, again, you can also, if you're successful as an indie author, you can outsource a lot of those things. You can pay for them. But I think the mindset of, well, I created a piece of art, so people should give me money. It's a little bit toxic, because at the end of the day, nobody owes you their money just because you made something. And it's the same for a business creating a product. Just because they made a product doesn't mean that they're owed sales. It's again, it's, I know you're putting a piece of yourself out there, and as a creative, it can be a lot more, I don't know what the word is, disappointing maybe, when people don't seem to like your product or just don't know about it as much. But that's just the struggle of every business and every creative out there. And so you do have to do something to sell yourself. Whether that's, you know, I know some authors in this community that do make their own covers, they do edit all their own books, they do format, and they enjoy all of those things. Like, if that's another thing, if you don't enjoy every aspect of creating a book, it may very well be that writing is the only part you enjoy, and then maybe your career looks a little differently. You just really have to find like what works for you. But I think the mindset of, I'm just going to create and then it should find its audience and I should get all the money and all the success, is very toxic and not a good approach to have. So I hope that summed it up. Again, I'm kind of scatterbrained today, but
no, those are my... You hit all the nails, and I can only agree with you. I think in my life, almost everyone that I surround myself with is a creative in some form or capacity, whether that be their full-time job or their part-time job, anything from photography and cinematography to, you know, creating medical devices from scratch to art to whatever. Like, almost everybody I know does this, either for the love of it or because it's something that they find like, this is what I want as a career. Like, that, yeah. But the one thing I've noticed is that, as you said, you have to want it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And you have to be willing to put your nose to the grindstone. I think people, especially, this is a small group of people, but it's where I see the most kind of hiccups and like annoyances personally, is like the new folks who came into BookTok, you know, around the pandemic, and then BookTok kind of got bigger and bigger. And then they go, I'm going to try and write a book of whatever genre, you know, mostly like romance or whatever. And then they find out that it's hard.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, what? Right. Right. Whoever thought that, or whoever told people that art is easy, I don't know where that happened, but it's not. Like, creating something is not easy. And so why do you think that it's going to be easy for you to put your writing out there? It just, yeah. I don't know where that mentality came from. And it's just frustrating because sometimes, you know, Bex is a great example. You know, we were like, how do you write so much? And so, you know, and she goes, you know, I'm disabled and, you know, I'm able to stay at home, but I'm also chronically ill and, mm-hmm. you know, all of these things. So I live a different life than, you know, a mom of four working a full-time job or whatever situation you find yourself in. But you have to make the time and space with what you're given.
Yeah.
And if you don't take advantage of that, then you can't blame anybody else. You can't blame the algorithm. You can't blame, you know, not being popular or not having enough followers. You truly can't. So I don't, that mentality really annoys me. Cause you know, I've never once been like, I just can't believe that my TikTok is not like in the millions of followers. I don't create content very often. You know what I mean? Like, right. I just don't. I had one video go viral and I got most of my followers from that. Mm-hmm. And then since then it's just been kind of stagnant. And I'm like, yep, right. Cause that's all the effort I'm putting into it.
Yeah.
And there are people on here, are people who are in the chat right now, who work their butts off to have engagement, to continue to grow followers, to put in the work, to self-help, to do all of these things because they love it.
Right.
Anyway, that's my like mini rant. Yeah. I don't know if that made any sense, but
yeah, no, we're both scatterbrained today, but no. I totally agree. I think it's a lot of people, you know, who thought writing is an easy career, and they're coming to the slow realization that it's not, not at least not any easier than any other career.
I think someone sold them a lie somewhere, I think, along the way. Truly. Yeah. Like, I don't, it just became a mentality. And look, I am the first person to be like, I love cozy. If I don't have to work, right, I'm not gonna work. I'm gonna do the things I like to do. I'm gonna watch movies. I'm gonna hang out with my friends. I don't want to have to like bleed every day if I don't have to. Right. But that means that that's my limitation. I know my limitations, and I know I'm not gonna hit a threshold if I don't try hard enough to do that. So it's like, who said that you write a romance and then you're going to get famous? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, I like that last point that you added, that because I'm also very much, you know, a big proponent of work-life balance, including in like your own side hustles, like they can too become too much work and too stressful and all of those things. So I don't want it to sound like we're advocating for like a toxic grind culture by any means. It's just there's a flip side to that of people who want to put in very little effort and get max results.
And have it happen fast, because you're right. I'm not advocating for grind, because I hate the work-life like grind culture that we ourselves in. It's more of like sometimes success is going to take longer than you expect. Mm-hmm. And maybe instead of putting 6 months of hard work of grinding every day, it takes you a year and a half because you found a better balance, and you got to be willing to wait for that. Right.
Yeah.
And you still might get to the end of that book and put it out there and it gets 5 downloads. And then if that pisses you off, which is okay, because you're like, this is a great book. I love this book. I love this project. I love whatever. And you want people to read it. Mm-hmm. But if you've done the minimum amount of work, and you're not hitting hundreds of downloads, you have to look at yourself and be like, okay, what do I adjust going forward? who do right. I ask for advice? What am I doing? And I feel like people, yeah, I feel like people don't want to do that. So
yeah. River says this is such an encouraging conversation for me right now. Well, that's great to hear, because I hope I didn't want it to come off as like we're pushing the grind mentality like right. to the max, because I am the first person to tell you I know how toxic that can be, because I did that 100%. In my early 20s and it burned me out for literal years. So
yeah, same.
Definitely don't do that, because it's just as bad. You might get successful. I'm not saying it won't work, but you mm-hmm. will. The effects on your mental state aren't going to be good for you. So
yeah, 100%.
Totally not advocating for that side at all. You know, I know there's some people there's variety in how people can work too. Like some people are very, you know, they just want to work all the time and they're fine mm-hmm. doing that. Yeah. And I know people like that and they're totally fine. So, you know, it's really about you and finding what works for you. And then like Ash said, if something isn't working, you know, look inward and figure out what you can do differently going forward and all of that, because that's, if your first reaction is to blame everything else, you're not going to get anywhere as a creative. And right. it's a harsh truth, but it's still a truth. And one that I think a lot of people have yet to learn in their creative endeavors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the effort component of it, as River was saying too, like, yeah, I have to remind myself that a lot. Like I have to go, oh, yeah, you haven't put any effort into your writing recently. Why? What is it, because you're busy with your social life? Usually, yes. I'm a very social person. But then it's like, okay, maybe I'm being too social and there's a balance to be had. And that was last year for me, mm-hmm. was switching my vocabulary from I need to write to I want to write. Yeah. And when I want to write, find out when that works best for me. And that mm-hmm. was a long process. And River says, I struggle with mismatched motivation. I'm trying to finish my draft by March. So it's just a good reminder. Yeah. I mean, people set goals for themselves and hold fast. River, I do not set goals for myself because it paralyzes me if I have to hold myself accountable to these goals. So I had to loosen up those restrictions and just be like, follow the flow of your creativity, but be aware of when that happens. And so, yeah, it's just like adjust where you need to adjust. There's no right way to write a book.
Yeah. And touching on your social life aspect, because I think you mentioned it in our year review episode that you enjoy like a slow, cozy life. So, you know, if that's what works for you, that's great. Like, you know how to, you know, structure your life in a way that's healthy for you. And I think some people also struggle with accepting that they might work better in like a slower pace than they might want. Like I had to deal with that last year too. I think both mm-hmm. of us talked about it mm-hmm. a lot on the podcast. You know, I had really ambitious goals for getting like my debut out and all of that. And a lot mm-hmm. of it didn't pan out just because I realized I was pushing too hard and it wasn't something that I was happy doing long-term. So mm-hmm. I've also realized that I just like to take my time with certain things.
Right.
And that's totally fine. So if someone does different and they work faster than me and they get their book out faster and it does well, I'm not going to look at that and be upset about it really. Maybe I'll mm-hmm. wish to some degree that I could do that, because there's always going to be that little bit of envy. Right. But mm-hmm. I think knowing what works for you and what creates a healthy lifestyle for you is super important, and recognizing that it's going to be different for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100%.
Well, I think that covers that topic. We have a few fun writing topics to move into. I know we do this every episode, our work in progress check-in. I don't have any updates because, like I said, I've been crunching on formatting and like publishing prep for Blades for Hire, so it's left very little room for my other writing. But
yeah.
And then there was also the holidays, so I just didn't get much done of anything over the holidays, which I think is probably how most of us feel. But I did want to give you space if you had a different update. But if not, like we said just a few minutes ago, that's totally fine.
That's also okay. No, so I have had zero words written, but I'm dipping my toes back into plotting, which has been genuinely so enjoyable for the first time, I think, ever. So it's been feeling really good to like get excited and start like looking at broader picture, because that's what this year is a focus for me on doing, is plotting. And that's, I'm not going to really write anything until, bye River. We'll see you later.
Hopefully. Thanks for joining, River.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I'm sure I'll write, obviously that's just like what happens, but my primary focus is going to be plotting. So I think I need to plot then over the, I'm giving myself like some loose parameters. I was like, I would really like to have the whole plot drafted and ready to go in like a multi-form, like multi-chapter format, whatever, yeah, by my birthday. And then that's mid-year roughly. So then I can tilt into actually writing the latter half of the year. So anyway, no words written, but plotting. Huzzah.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's all great too, because, you know, I think we both learned last year that we might be bigger plotters than we realized, so.
Yeah, out of necessity rather than, and that's,
yeah,
that was the thing too. I know we talked about this, but it's been, like I said, the first time I've been excited to do that, and I'm really, in a way that I didn't expect, like really stoked to get to know my characters and my story more.
Yeah.
And I never really experienced that as I was writing as I went along, because I think I was just more focused on like getting words on paper, which is also something that most people need to do, and same.
Yeah.
But I was interested less in the world building or forcing the world building rather than being like immersed in it. So feeling more like I'm about to dive in, which is a cool feeling.
Well, that's our work in progress sort of updates. So we're going to move into our writing topics, but we touched a little bit on this one as far as pricing goes, but we're going to kind of flip the switch on how we talk about this topic next. It's story length. As I was formatting Blades for Hire, I was just looking at all the different like variations in how the short, how long the short stories are and things like that. And then looking at some of my own work and you know, plotting documents and things like that. And I was curious, because I don't think we ever had this conversation on Quill and Query yet. How do you approach story length, and then like for your debut series length, like do you have solid goals for things like that in mind? Like, do you set word count goals or book count goals or page count goals or anything like that, or are you more of a I'm just gonna let the story take shape and use as many words or pages as it needs? I think everyone's, you know, kind of a balance between the two, right? But I was just curious how it works for you, like when you start to plot a story and when you're thinking about it, the story length.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the Blade for Hire was hard because I'm a long-winded kind of gal. And I know I went over a little bit, but, you know.
You weren't the worst to win over, so it's okay.
I know. I did read. I'm aware of there are some others, which is okay. You know, like it's our first anthology. Yeah. But yeah, I was like, as I was editing and going along, I was like, dang, I'm like, I've edited as much as I possibly can to get all the information and keep the story coherent. Yeah. And unfortunately, it's just over 20,000 words. But yeah, I'm a long-winded person. So for me, at least for A Filthy Hunger, and so I want the Book of Witnesses, it's planned in my mind as a three book, like a trilogy, with maybe like a novella thrown in there. So I want them to be thick. I'm a high fantasy person, so I love longer length novels, and I think that's where I'm just going to naturally gravitate towards. I don't have page or word limitations. I do, however, keep mentally, I need it to be 50 chapters at most, or at least I'm thinking at most.
Yeah.
And I only bring this up because it's split between two points of view. And I think that 25 and halfway through the book, the two points of view come together and they exist in the same space.
Yeah.
So I think between 40 and 50, but 50 is a good max. It's split half, 25 chapters for Kara, 25 chapters for Baltair. Together they come, and then the plot kind of takes them away. That's kind of where I'm at. And I have a feeling that'll probably be, you know, I'm thinking like 400 to 500 pages, but I don't know, Page is weird because like different sizes of book formats and things like that, and things will get cold and whatever. So I feel like page limitations for me in my mind is a block. But 50 chapters. I try and keep my chapters within like the same word length. So 2,500 words to 3,000 words per chapter right now in the non-edited phase. That's kind of where I'm at. And if I start to go over for one character, I'm like, oh, nope, stop that.
Yeah.
But we'll see. What about you? Do you have any, are you like a word count person?
So usually when I'm starting a story, both for my short stories and A Knight of Knives, I start with kind of like a broad word count goal. So I'll set a number that's indicative of what I think I'll need to tell the story. It's not strict by any means. Like I can go under, I can go over. It's just kind of to give me an idea of about how long I think the story is going to be and how to structure the plot. So when I'm doing my outline, I can kind of, you know, make estimates of this chapter is going to be this long. This chapter will probably be this long. And then I can structure like the acts accordingly and make sure I'm hitting my story beats the way I want to. And things like that. But, series length is something that's a little harder for me to guess. Like with A Knight of Knives, I always go back and forth between two and three books. I think that's something I'm not going to know until I'm done with book one.
Right.
And then like maybe even a decent way into book two. It just really depends. I know how the series ends and all the beats I want to hit in between for the most part. It's just, I don't know how many words it's really going to take me to get there. So it may end up being the case that I only need two books, or it may end up being that the story grows as I write it and it needs three. So
yeah,
I think that's great. Something that comes more with like experience of publishing and getting through a series that I just don't have yet. So that is a little bit harder for me to predict. But word count goals, I feel like I generally am pretty close. Like with my short story for Blades for Hire, I shot for, initially I was going to go for the longer and I was trying to do 20,000. And then time caught up with me. So I shifted my goals to be one of the more mid-length stories. So about 10,000. I got a little over that at like 13,000. So not too far off. And a lot of that came in editing too. I think the first beta that I sent out was like 12,000. So added like 1,000 words in editing because there was some missing stuff that I just really needed to touch on. But I think I'm pretty decent at predicting like the ballpark word count that I'll need. Series length is just something that obviously I don't have the experience with yet. So I imagine it'll get easier over time, but
No, I feel that. I mean, maybe the Book of Witnesses for me will be like a duology with like a novella at the end or whatever. But I think I like a trilogy. I'm just like a natural trilogy girl. Some of my favorite works though have been duologies. So, it does just depend. And I found myself naturally kind of realizing where I'm falling per chapter word count. And after 9 chapters, I was like, okay, we're sticking to the 2,500 to 3,000 word length. And if you catch yourself going over, but I think it's a good mindset to have like in your regard too, where you're like, I'm gonna just let the story take as long as it needs to take, and if that ends up being 2, great, 3, great. I need to kind of loosen my hold on the trilogy, I think, and have that kind of mindset too, just in case, because I feel like unfortunately a lot of like longer series tend to hit like book 4 slumps where people are like, what are we doing here? And even there's like I can't even remember the name of the whole phrase for this kind of concept, but the second book scaries where people are like, it was really boring.
You know,
and I just like don't ever want someone to say my work is boring. It'll happen, I know, but like only because I forced a 3-book series and didn't know when to just keep it down to 2. So totally understand.
Yeah, I think I naturally gravitate towards trilogies just because that's what I'm used to reading. I read a lot of trilogies or standalone, so that's what I gravitate towards writing. And then I forgot where I was going with that, but it was to comment on something you said at the beginning, and I was supposed to keep a mental note of it, but did not do a good job of that.
No mental notes tonight, Brandon. We don't have the capacity for that.
Yeah, right. Well, I think what I was going to get at was I can predict what I'm going to write to some extent because I know what I like to read, and that's also what I like to write. So like you said, I think you said you like to write or you like to read fantasy, which tends to be longer. So yeah. I'm kind of in the same ballpark where it's like, I know my book's going to be on the longer side of of a debut because that's just what I gravitate towards and what I read and the stories that I enjoy.
Yeah, totally agree.
All right, well, moving into our next topic, this is one that I like to dive into with people all the time as far as like talking about books from both reading and writing perspectives, and that's unanswered questions. So as a writer, I think it's important to understand the difference between something that's deliberately left open to interpretation or ambiguous versus something that really doesn't come to a satisfying conclusion. And in a lot of reader spaces, I feel like those two things can get confused sometimes. Not always, but and then also in the writer space too, I think newer authors, myself included, struggle to find a balance between how do you not answer and spell everything out, but also provide satisfying answers at the same time? So I kind of wanted to get your thoughts both as a reader and a writer is how do you distinguish between the two, like between something that feels like it was just never resolved and something that is more deliberately left ambiguous or open to interpretation as far as like a plot thread goes or something. And then how does that affect your writing?
Yeah, that's actually, I've never had a conversation about this before. And it's interesting that you bring this up because I do feel that was a lot of the feedback I got in the short story beta stuff was for the folks who did beta read, they were like, oh, like, I'm not quite sure if you're going to answer this later on, but I don't quite understand this, which is valid. Mm-hmm. I am a writer who I enjoy, and I've said this before, but I like being dropped in the middle of a story and almost like a Hansel and Gretel situation where I get like little bits and pieces of breadcrumbs that lead me to the conclusion or to the answer that the writer wants me to get to. Mm-hmm. I like doing that as well. I like almost having to like work for the story a little bit. And I know some people don't like that. They want to be able to just like, here's the world, here's where we're functioning, and then we can get into the character-based story or whatever. Because I'm such a plot-focused world-building kind of writer, I enjoy the here's a little bit of knowledge here. I want you to feel like my character where they don't know everything.
Yeah.
And so if a question comes up, it might not be answered until either the very end or it's a mystery until the second book. That's me as like a writer. As a reader, I enjoy the same thing. When it becomes unsatisfying is when the writer harps on and on about an unknown for so long, whether it be just the book or the duology or whatever. And then it is a 2-page answer, right? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's, you've waxed poetic about the complications of A, B, and C, and the answers to those questions take up little to no space in the conclusion of those questions. There are very few. Honestly, Sarah J. Maas does that a lot. She'll give out a complicated reasoning for something to happen, and then the answer is just like, what? That doesn't make sense in the realm of your world. An example is, spoiler alert, if you care, for those who are listening or who haven't read, plug your ears for the next 20 seconds. The main character, Farah, gets pregnant, and then her life is threatened. Because apparently, if you have a baby with wings, despite living in a world of magic, of impossible magic, you die as a woman because your hips and birth canal can't support having a baby with wings when you give birth. And it's like, but you have magic. You can literally shapeshift. What do you mean you can't do this? And the answer is just because. That's when it gets annoying to me, where we've built up an entire hundreds and hundreds of page book to then be given, sorry, it's just not possible. It's not feasible. Mm-hmm. And it's like, but I have questions. Like, I, what do you mean? Like, you can ship, yeah. you can do all these things and it's still not possible. Go deeper. Why? Like, mm-hmm. is it just to make this character give up her power? Yeah. And so that's when it pisses me off, when it's used as a tool, and a very weak tool at that, to make a character act a certain way. I know that was like a long rant, but yeah. that's kind of, I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, yeah, I get it. Okay. It sounds like Nicole might have some thoughts. I see.
Sorry if I spoiled Nicole. I mean, yeah, it's the lazy answers that get me. I don't care if it takes me 5 books to get an answer, mm-hmm. and I've been chomping at the bit to figure out the who, the where, the what, and the why. But it's a lazy answer. It's a lazy solution that really grinds my gears. It's like, you know, mm-hmm. you made me work. Where's my reward? And it's a one pager? No. No way. If it is not integral to the character's arc or the plot itself, it shouldn't be in there. And it doesn't need to be answered. Yeah. How yeah. do you feel about it?
Yeah, I think you made great points. I think the line is very difficult to define, and a lot of it depends on how you're selling it to, like, how you're selling the question and the future answer to the reader. So trying to think of a good example here from like A Song of Ice and Fire, because it's unfinished. But something that was set up a lot in book 5 is these magical horns. So there's Dragonbinder, which supposed to bind the dragons to someone, but at the cost of a life. But as of right now, we don't even know if that's how it works. It's all purely like hearsay. And then there's also the Horn of Winter, which is supposed to bring down the wall and things like that. And with Martin, you're not entirely sure if these are just legends or if this is how these items actually work. So a good example of like a poorly resolved plot thread for me would be if we just never got an answer to those, because they were set up as having a significant impact in book 6 and 7. So if it turns out that we just like never hear about those items again, or they just turn out to be these very insignificant trinkets that really don't do anything, I think that would be an example of the kind of answers that I don't like. Right. Where it's, you know, you set this up to be this grand thing that was going to have these big consequences, and it doesn't even have to pan out exactly that way. But
yeah,
if it just turns out that there's more questions than answers in the next book and we'd never find out more about these things, I think that's a good example of how not to do it. But again, it really just depends on like how you set these things up for the reader. Like if you're setting something up to have a significant impact on the plot, and then the answer to that question that the reader has had all this time is very insignificant. Not saying there aren't ways you can't do that effectively, because I think some authors do kind of do that subversion pretty well. But that's an even trickier line to walk, in my opinion.
Yeah, totally.
But I'm very much like you, where I like to kind of work for the story and figure things out. And so I don't need everything spelled out right away either. I like to learn about the world as the characters do. And I do like certain elements of the story to kind of just be unanswered sometimes, not in the way that I just touched on as an example, but more like I'm given the clues to kind of come to my own conclusion about something. That's something a lot of the stories I really like do, like A Song of Ice and Fire. A lot of times you're presented with information from different perspectives and you're never really given the answer on what is 100% right. It's just, here's how this character thinks of it. Here's how this character saw it. You make your own judgment on what actually happened. And I think that's also a really good way to do it, is to present things from like different perspectives. And then kind of let the reader make their own interpretation from there. But yeah, I think that's just one of those tricky lines to walk, especially like early in your author career, that you want to be really conscious of, is walking that line between, you know, spelling everything out and providing satisfying conclusions to things, and also leaving things up to imagination and open to interpretation to some extent.
Yeah, no, you laid out some great concepts there. I think I totally agree with all of them. I think it's interesting with new authors. There is like an overeagerness, mm-hmm. personally, because I experience this with myself, yeah. of wanting to have a lot to hook people, to keep them interested. And there's a danger in that. And I think mm-hmm. that's where new authors end up having this issue of unanswered questions, not for the sake of having them unanswered, but because they got lost in the plot. Yeah. And objects seem to be a common theme in a lot of it. Like Sarah J. Maas does this. I will continue to harp on her. But, you know, I think that can be a danger, because I'm going to imbue objects in my story, but they have to, like, I'm going to do my history lesson on them for myself personally and make sure that they get reused. But it is so easy to forget. Oh, yeah, like that thing does come into play, the Horn of mm-hmm. Winter, whatever. You know, you're just kind of like, okay, but is this like a long plot, or is this yeah. like we forgot about it kind of a thing? And it gets hard the longer and longer your series goes too. Another a worry for me, less like commentary, but a worry for me is that my love of having the reader be like a character and not have all the answers is that in what I've seen in a recent shift of like shorter stories, shorter novels, more self-published works, that like people will get so used to having their answers almost immediately and spelled out that they won't want to put the time and effort to explore and to have the mystery that I'm trying to provide.
Yeah.
I know. And again, it's not everyone's cup of tea. I totally understand. Like, sometimes you just want things spelled out for you, especially if it's overly complicated. Mm-hmm. But I guess it has to be done in a way that I think, like, Brandon Sanderson does a great job of imbuing answers and world building into action. So at the beginning of Mistborn, you know, you're like, how do you have powers like this? And within like the first 150 pages, you get some answers to that through the main character learning about this on her own, like you are learning alongside her. Mm-hmm. And I like that avenue of storytelling more. I just worry that people's attention spans maybe are getting shorter. I mean, yeah. I know this for a fact, but that they won't want to, yeah, spend the time trying to go on this journey with me.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, 'cause that's actually like my number one fear too with my writing. 'Cause
not alone.
Yeah, no. 'Cause, a lot of my favorite books, like you really have to get to the end of the novel to really right. get the answers that you start the book with. And that's the kind of story that I've always loved to read. I have, you know, the patience for it. And I think mm-hmm. there's, you know, obviously the author has to keep you invested along the way, but those are just the kind of stories I like to read. I don't like everything spelled out on page 10. I like to think about it and figure it out and then, you know, see how my conclusions line up with what actually happens.
Yeah.
A recent example of a book I read, the first book in First Law, The Blade mm-hmm. itself, is very difficult to understand where the plot is going until you get to the end of the book. And it's like a 500 page book. And I really wonder how that would do if it was released today as opposed to when it actually came out, which was I think like 15 years ago at least at this point.
Yeah.
It just makes me wonder, because like you said, we know attention spans are getting shorter and a lot of people do like to have the answers right away, and mm-hmm. so for me that creates a concern with my story, because it's like, well, I can't write that way. That's just not the story that
right.
that I want to tell. So I don't necessarily want that to hurt me. Like, I don't want people to DNF because they're like, oh, the answers weren't there right away. And I'm like, well, if, right. you know, if you got to the end, they would have been. But right. I think that's just something about, you know, trusting your reader and trusting that your book is going to find the people that it appeals to, which I think is also a difficult thing to kind of come to terms with, is that your book will probably reach people that just their attention span doesn't maybe line up with what you're trying to accomplish, and maybe it's not their thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's like my biggest fear with all of my writing too, because those are the kind of stories that I like to read and that's what I want to yeah. write. And so yeah. that's a big worry for me.
Yeah, I genuinely would hate for like person A, who 5 years ago loved stories like this, because mm-hmm. of TikTok and Instagram or whatever, just doesn't have the patience, but it would resonate with them. You know, you're like, oh, if yeah. only I knew. But you're right. You have to trust that your book's going to get to the people that it needs to get to, and you know, I'm a historian by trade, so I like my history, and I know some people aren't going to enjoy that being imbued in the story. And yeah, it, I guess we can play the what ifs and the, oh, I would hate this and hate that. But as you said, I think those are wise words of just, you have to trust that your book is going to land in the laps of people who it's meant to be in front of, you know?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't know how many other people out there are able to recognize it in themselves, but I know, at least for myself, that my attention span just sucks sometimes. And so usually if I'm like reading something and I'm noticing that I just like can't do it right now, I can't follow or something, like I'll be able to put the book down and be like, it's not the book right now. It's just me. So I need to come back to it when I'm in like a better focused state. I'm like that with a lot of things too. Like I do that with movies all the time where I'll try to watch one. Or a show. I'll be like, I'll put it on and I'll be like, I don't have the attention span for this right now. I need to watch it another night. I was just gonna say, there's the fact that I know I can do that means there's probably millions of other people who do the same thing. So I think also taking solace in that fact too, like they'll be able to pick up on, you know, maybe they're just having a bad reading day and they can't focus.
I was gonna say, I am the exact, I'm such a mood reader and a mood watcher. I think I'm in the middle of a total of 7 books. And I will pat myself on the back. I'm one of those people who can like be gone from a book for months and then jump in and remember where I'm at. Like,
yeah, same.
Remember what had happened and whatever. Like, I was trying to go through my, you know, TBR and I'm like, oh yeah, no, I remember where I'm at in this one. I open the book. I'm like, oh yeah, cool. Okay, no, I remember this too. I don't have to start over again. But yeah, I'm the exact same way. So I also recognize that as well. I guess I just worry about the principle of the thing, you know. It's like, if it's not time, it's totally not time, but it could be time later. So don't give up.
All right. Well, I have one kind of smaller topic for us today that I wanted to touch on too. This one's about writing for other age groups. So I think both of us pretty much predominantly read adult books. And then as far as our current works in progress go, I think we're both focused on adult audiences at the moment. But I was wondering if you ever could picture yourself or see a future where you do write a series or a book geared towards another age group. Or target audience. I just don't know if that's something you thought about. But I've seen some authors in our space who do predominantly write like adult fantasy, say they want to tackle something like a middle grade fantasy at some point. So I was curious about if you've thought about that.
I would be totally open to it. I actually, up until like the last couple of years, read pretty predominantly YA, like older YA, teens. And I had such a blast. Some of my favorite series are technically considered like YA. I think YA gets a bad rap. Don't know why. It's probably because people are like, oh, there's not enough like enemies to lovers. So I get it. It's just not the book for you then. If it says YA, it means YA. People are always upset when like Holly Black doesn't have enough like sex in her novels. And I'm like, right, because she's like young adult, so I don't know what, you know. Anyway, I would be totally open to it. I don't have any plans currently, but I think it would be super fun to do something like that, especially like having a younger sister would be so cool to write. I mean, she'll be out of this age by the time I finally get published and like whatever. So, but you know, seeing her grow up and seeing what interest she has, it's really a great insight. And yeah, I'd be, could totally see myself writing a YA or a, maybe not middle grade. I don't know if I can get that, like, again, I'm like such a wax poetic person. I don't know if I could limit myself to like a smaller book, but I would love to work with like an illustrator. If an illustrator came to me and was like, look, I have all of these ideas and I would love to illustrate, I just don't know what, how to write. Totally, I would be 100% down to do that. That's so cool. And so like V.E. Schwab, she's written middle grade. I think she did Gallant, which was like not middle grade, but like YA. Holly Black did middle grade. She did the Spiderwick Chronicles, and she's done like an adult novel. So yeah, I think it's a good sign of an author to be able to kind of move in different age groups and still tell a fantastic story. I'm a fan. What about you? Do you ever expect yourself to write for your younger audience?
Pretty much same as you. I don't have any like solid plans for anything. I don't have any like young adult or middle grade series like ready to go or outlined or anything like that. But I would definitely love to at some point once I'm a little more confident in what I've already started working on, like once, you know, I'm in a better spot in my author journey, I think writing for other age groups would be super fun, especially just knowing how important books were to me growing up. I would love to create stories for people that do the same thing. You know, I think books played a big role in most of our childhoods. So at least if we're here. So I would totally love to explore writing for other age groups at some point. And there's not really any age group that I'm like opposed to writing for. The one that scares me the most is middle grade, just because I feel like I'm so far removed from that now that I don't know. Right. Like my biggest concern would be that I'm like, how do you do fellow kids like type of story, right? Like I don't want to
some Steve Buscemi shit. Yeah.
So that would be like my biggest concern. But I think, you know, like I said, once I'm further ahead in my author career, that'll probably be less of a concern because I'll be a little more confident in my skills then. But yeah, I think you brought up a great point too, that it's a sign of like a talented author if you can kind of pivot age groups. And I talk about them all the time, but that's one of my favorite things about George R. R. Martin is he's well known for A Song of Ice and Fire. But if you look at his entire bibliography, he's written across genres, across mediums. He's written for TV. Yeah. He has younger adult books and middle grade books out there too. There's really not anything that he hasn't written. So I think that's a really hard thing to find now. And it's totally valid if you're someone who's like, no, I just want to write adult fantasy and that's all I want to write. That's perfectly fine. I think for myself, I would like to explore other variety at some point. And I think it definitely is like a sign of a talented author. If you can pivot genre or age group or medium and things like that, I think that's like a really special kind of skill.
Yeah, no, totally. I was thinking genre as you were saying it, and then you said it, and I was like, oh yeah, 100%. I've got two other ideas that I've had in my head for a really long time, three actually, and they kind of, so yeah, like Book of Witnesses is obviously high fantasy, dark fantasy, whatever.
Yeah.
But like the other few are like, one's like speculative fiction, and then the other is like historical fiction. And another is just horror. Like, I mean, all of with some like kind of like slight, the world is not what it seems element. But yeah, I think being able to tell like a wide variety of stories is so cool. And it's like it's a skill I would like to continue to hone after I finish with this series.
Yeah. I have a bunch of like horror stories and some science fiction too, like in my books I need to write document.
I need to write.
But yeah, I just other genres are really cool and I would love to explore them more. Well, I think that's going to do it for our writing topics, and I don't have a writing resource this week either. I'm still working on finding some good ones for the year. I just wasn't able to find one in time for this, but...
No, that's okay. I would say I don't have an exact resource, but if you are compelled, I know a lot of people have lost. Same with North Carolina, still everyone needs in South Carolina and some parts in Eastern Tennessee, but with the wildfires out in LA, I know a lot of libraries have lost books, homes have lost books. So if I'm sure it's an easy Google search to go and donate to book related nonprofits to help people get back their collections and the public get back their books. So do what you can, if you can. It's a lot going on, so I know it can be overwhelming, but always encourage people to do that if they are willing.
Yeah, totally. Well, I think that's going to do it for our first episode for 2025. Ash, I'll give this space to, I think Nicole is the only one left in the audience. So Nicole, if you have any questions or anything you want to see from us going into 2025, be sure to let us know. I know we still have in our notes that you want to hear more about our works in progress. So still trying to figure out how to work that into the show, but we'll definitely get that to you. Like at some point we'll address that.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, I think maybe like the next time we don't have a guest on, we can do that.
Yeah. That would be fun if we did like a work in progress episode.
Yeah.
Kind of like a special Cool Inquiry episode. That would be cool. So I thought I clicked mute on something for a minute because something changed in the UI and I couldn't figure out what it was.
Oh, no, you're good. Did you get your little like... in halfway through our live, did you get the notification?
I actually didn't get that today. I don't know why.
I noticed. I was like, wait, we haven't gotten a little girl. Maybe it's...
They must be like, we're getting banned, so we don't care.
Yeah, yeah. I know. I guess we'll have to figure... We will definitely find a way to go live. I'm going to be really sad. I will say that these will be my closing comments. As much as TikTok is a time suck for me and a distraction, and there are a variety of reasons why we should all not be on TikTok... whatever.
Yeah.
But it's created such a great community that I'm going to be really sad to see people go. And I'm going to be sad to be gone if this happens. Mm-hmm. Not only because I've learned so much from everybody, but so many people that I am friends with utilize it to market their work. And it doesn't translate. I've tried a couple times this week to get people to follow my Blue Sky and my author Instagram, and it just you're never going to get those back unless you work really hard by posting every day, or you go viral on accident or whatever. So anyway, if it does go, we'll let everybody know where they can find us continuously, but I'm going to be really bummed. I'm going to be super bummed. So yeah. Yeah, like Nicole said, we wouldn't have met, you know? Like, ugh.
Yeah. Well, we'll definitely keep everyone posted where we go after TikTok. I will too be very sad to see the writing community kind of scatter. I've made several posts about where you can find me, Quill and Query, and I'm sure Ash has done the same. So if you want to stay in touch and keep watching Quill and Query and keep following our individual author journeys, we're pretty much everywhere.
Literally everywhere.
So definitely have a wide variety of sources for you to choose from, and we'll keep you posted on where our lives go. Like I said, I'm thinking YouTube first, but we'll make an official post somewhere soon. Well, with all of that said, thank you to everyone who has joined us on TikTok both today and in all of our many episodes. You guys are the best, and you're the reason we are able to continue to do the podcast not every week anymore, but every other week. Thank you guys again. And if we don't see you after the TikTok ban, it's been a pleasure.
Yes.
Streaming to you guys. And we hope you do well wherever you go. So.
Yep. All right. Signing off. Hopefully not for the last time. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
Bye, Nicole. It was good to see you. We'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Bye.